So that would be 7 days, Craig David.
What did
Yeah,
he do on the Monday?
Crashed into a polar bear.
Do you think that orange might mean death, Amy?
It's certainly a very appealing theory.
Oh, she's the polar opposite.
I think I can quote a famous philosopher when I say, "What's your flavor? Tell me what's your flavor."
This podcast was recorded remotely and may contain adult language and themes.
Hello and welcome to TV DNA, True Detective, Night Country, Episode 4. My name is Adam Hemming and I've been joined by Damien Cooper.
Santa's elves drowned in global warming, darling, and the rest are all meth heads.
And Neil Shepek.
Is there anyone in this town you haven't fucked?
Not many.
How is life in Hitchin?
As those two wonderful lines would suggest, there will be spoilers ahead for True Detective Night Country Episode 4. So if you haven't watched it yet, do pause this podcast, go and watch it, and then come back and listen to all of our wonderful insights, theories, and hilarious moments. Let's dive into this then. So, Neil, what did you think of the episode?
I really enjoyed it. I do think it was a bit of a filler episode, but we definitely found out more narrative and stuff about the characters. And just like Walking Dead and lots of the other shows that we've been following and analysing, I do think you do need episodes where you can pause and just kind of be in the moment and learn more about the characters, more about the background. And I think this episode did that very well.
Yeah, we mentioned last week there were a couple of characters we were kind of being reminded of. We get a little bit more of that this time around, but also the conclusion of one of those character stories. What did you think, Damon?
As I said in the WhatsApp after I'd finished watching it, I didn't love it. I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it. I think I agree, Neil. It did feel a bit fillerish for a lot of the episode. And then suddenly, the last 10 minutes or so, loads of stuff happened. So, yeah, I wasn't a fan of the pacing. And as I said previously, I am just worried about it becoming supernatural. And I don't really enjoy that. If we are setting it in a world where the supernatural exists, fine. But this feels incredibly realistic. And so it just jars a bit too much for me.
Yeah, I remember before you not being a huge fan of the supernatural content. It's a fiction. At school at the moment, we're studying the Gothic with vampires and werewolves and etc. You know, this is all part of storytelling. And they're normally either metaphors or metaphors for things that we study in life and think about. It's storytelling.
What's the metaphor?
What's a metaphor? Well, as an English teacher, it's using something else to represent a reality.
Yeah, but what's a metaphor?
It reminds me of the joke that I always used to tell my English teacher when we were studying. Is it John Donne? I once met a physical poet. Anyway, yeah, I guess so far, whilst I think it is hinting very much at the supernatural, it can still all be explained by the psychological or potentially the chemical. And I think the key part of this is that so far, no two characters have experienced the same phenomenon, right?
Are you sure? There's some of them that have experienced the same phenomenon, like the deaths.
Similar phenomenon, but not necessarily at the same time, right? So what Navarro has seen, you could say that what Navarro sees and what Jules sees within this very episode are the same thing, but they are slightly different, I think. Not like Liz is seeing the same thing that Navarro is seeing at the same time. So potentially it could still all be either a psychological thing or, you know, some sort of chemical through the dirty water that's being produced that's causing these people to behave in the way that they are or see the things that they're seeing.
Well, a psychological thing.
Well, this goes into very much part of the end of this episode, right, where Navarro is talking to Liz about her sister, who's done exactly what her mother has done. She's basically walked out not exactly. Her mother leaves, we're told, and is found killed.
But the sister also does exactly what the scientists did.
Yes, indeed. where Navarro is relating that to a sort of family mental illness, whereas it could be those, the mother and the and her sister are two very different things, and that it's not a hereditary thing that's going on with Jules. It's more of a geographical thing with where they are in Innes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just comparing it to season one, I mean, season one is a horror, classic Southern Gothic horror. Whereas this, I think particularly the scene between Navarro and Rose made me think it is definitely more of a, it has more of a supernatural horror energy to it. I just felt that more and more this episode, which is probably why I felt myself disengaging with it. Because whilst I know I was not on last week's pod when we talked about episode three, I really enjoyed episode three.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, my criticism of this episode would be that there's a lot of stuff that we've kind of already seen or already expected or predicted was going to happen. You know, we get more of Liz being mean to Pete and dragging him away from his family. You know, there's a lot of stuff that just felt a little bit repeated and like, you know, let's move on. We're not necessarily developing character here. We're just treading the same ground a little bit. But let's go through it then. So we open with, again, white noise. It's Liz in bed. Interestingly enough, the time on her clock was 3:30 a.m., which was the same time that Pete got home and woke up his family the night before. But Danvers replaying Annie's video, and we get this a lot throughout the episode, right?
She's yeah.
now pretty much obsessed with watching this video again and again and again. She picks up different things at different times. As she sees it, she weirdly goes into Leah's room and moves her hair whilst she's sleeping, which I thought was a bit creepy and unnecessary. And then we're into, she's up and she's out and about, and it's Christmas Eve, 24th of December, seventh day of night.
So that would be 7 days, Craig David.
And again, what did he do on the Monday?
Crashed into a polar bear. Yeah, the fact that it was Christmas Eve did make me think, like, is this going to be sort of folk? I think they made certain decisions with this episode around the fact that it was Christmas Eve, and having to sort of navigate that maybe is a reason why it felt like such a filler episode. I don't know.
I mean, it's not going to go down as like one of those amazing Christmas episodes. You know, some people talk about, I don't know, I was about to say Father Ted. I don't mean Father Ted. I mean Ted Lasso. People talk about, you know, the Christmas episodes of that being fantastic. Brooklyn Nine-Nine, all these kind of epic shows that have season after season. I don't think this is going to go down in the catalogue.
Speaking of Christmas episodes, there was I made a comparison between Grace at Christmas Day and Jamie Lee Curtis in The Bear on Christmas Day, and how put together she was. Is it Grace or is it Rose? Rose, is it?
Rose you're talking about, yeah. Rose,
sorry, yeah. Fiona Shaw's character.
I thought you were talking about our very own Grace Chapman.
It's not a Friday.
No. No, definitely not. Anyway, the bodies are being packed up, off, shipped off to Anchorage. Connolly is there. We get more Christopher Eccleston, fittingly, after we released on this very day our Doctor Who Christopher Eccleston episode. Anyway, he's there. And then as Liz is on her way to go and sort him out, she sees Julia taking her clothes off. And she gets an elbow in her face. Manages to get a jacket over her and gets her to the station.
Well, she gets her to the lighthouse, which is a facility for looking after people who are disturbed. We find out later that Julia, the sister, leaves because she's not committed to being there. I think that was a big character development for Navarro. Just, you know, what happened with Julia and the fact that she left, and then obviously the end when she walks into the ice.
Yeah, well, she's always been, I'm not going to put her in that place. I'm not going to put her in that place. She won't go back, because when she was committed before, she struggled with the pills they were putting her on. So, but it feels like the case is sort of weighing heavy on Navarro, and that probably plays a part in her finally accepting that she has to go into the lighthouse. But yeah, I feel like Jules is happy to be there initially.
But then something happens, and we obviously don't know what that is.
Well, I think because we've moved forward quite a bit there, I think I agree that it is the case that makes Evangelina go, right, something, I can't do this anymore. I have to do this other thing. But the other thing we see, or that is interesting, is once Danvers has collected her, brought her to the police station, and then we cut to Navarro having a chat with her, with Danvers standing in the doorway, kind of half listening in, is that we're seeing also just the relationship between Evangelina and Liz starting to strengthen again, go back to possibly what it was before it all went wrong with that guy that either was or was not dead. That's
character really development.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that I do think is done well in this episode. I know you guys were talking about in episode 3 about the two of them in the car talking, which kind of mirrors what happens in season 1. And we get another one of those scenes. I know I'm now jumping about the place, but we get another one of those scenes in this episode. And I do think that is when True Detective is at its strongest, when we have the two leads in a car talking about philosophy, religion, life.
Let's continue jumping about a bit, because I want to just pick up on why Jules left the lighthouse. Because, of course, an orange rolls out from under her bed.
There's a dead body under her bed.
Well, it's some sort of reanimated body under her bed. Is this the same boomer orange that Navarro threw up a hill?
Good question. I was looking into this about what does the orange mean? And I have seen this theory that in TV and film, an orange certainly rolling on the ground signifies death. One of the classic examples, Adam, I know one of your favourite films, The Godfather Part 1, where Vito Corleone is shot down and he has a bag full of oranges and they go everywhere. And then obviously in The Godfather Part 3, Michael Corleone is holding an orange and he dies and we just see the orange fall to the ground. So, yes, it's the idea that maybe the orange signifies death. And so we have Navarro in the previous episode throwing it and it coming back to her, meaning she's trying to escape death, but death comes back to her. And obviously her sister in the lighthouse sees it roll from underneath her. She looks under bed. She sees this dead person. And, you know, we then know that she goes off to the sea.
I wasn't aware of the Godfather connections, but the fact that she sees an orange and then looks under the bed and there's a dead person, I immediately thought that orange means death.
I didn't make that connection. I just thought it was the same boomer orange. But that's brilliant. I love that. And the one thing that I noticed about the body under the bed was that it was wearing a cross. And I think this is kind of key later on, because it lends a little bit of credence to what I was saying earlier about these being different people, because the people that Navarro sees at various points aren't wearing crosses.
I think also there is something not necessarily religious in the sense of organised religion, which obviously the cross does represent, that is organised religion, but there's a spirituality. And I do wonder whether this is more to do with spirituality than the supernatural.
Well, I can get on board with that. I prefer that more to something weird and kind of we can't properly explain it. But I think the other thing as well to think about is that she's wearing a cross, therefore meaning she's Christian. But this show also deals with what it means to be a native of the land, an Inuit person, shall we say.
Inuit.
Apologies for my ignorance. But it's the idea of what their existence is like, how they are trying to maintain that. We see it throughout all of these episodes, the passing on of their culture and their history. But meanwhile, we have this other, I guess, European-based religious military industrial complex, for want of a better phrase, coming in and taking over. And so here we have a woman who is ethnically native to Alaska, although she's wearing a cross. So she's taken on, you know, she's a Christian and she is now dead. So what does that mean? Is she a cipher for the old ways being gone? And that cross is not just a cross around it, but also a noose.
Nice. Let's go back to the beginning, try and recover some semblance of order. But I just wanted to point out, last week we speculated on the fact that the end of the credit sequence might be different every week because I hadn't spotted that hut before, and indeed it is. So this time around there was no hut, but we had the sort of police jeep shining the headlights across the ice instead.
Yeah, and just something else to do with the opening credits, because I was now obviously scanning them far more than I do usually. Usually I'm just like, come on, hurry up, I want to get to the drama. There is also orange peel at least once, and I think an orange separately, as well as what else we have? We have the one-eyed polar bear, something hanging down, I think, which is similar to one of the things that we see hanging from the roof in the mobile home.
Do you think that orange might mean death, Damo?
It's certainly a very appealing theory.
Oh.
Very good. Let's talk about Pete's discovery then. Pete, who is a miracle of overcoming shitty genetics, he's got something on the medical records of people with similar injuries. And what he's got is Otis Heiss. He's a German national. He has no records of employment, no bank accounts, no credit cards. And he's had no address for the past 8 years.
How does your Otis feel about this?
Well, I haven't let my seven-year-old boy watch True Detective. But funnily enough, we found out there was an Adam in the show as well this week, didn't we? It was a Hemingway episode. This Otis chap has suffered these same injuries and became a junkie after, they call it the accident, but there was no cause discovered of the accidents. They don't know how he suffered these injuries. But since then, he's been essentially a bit of a drifter, got a bit of a petty crime jacket going on. But yeah, essentially, he's a bit of a mystery. But Liz wants him found, so she asks Pete to put out an APB on him as well as on Clark. So they're looking for him as well as Clark. And that's going to mean a whole load of admin for Pete on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, poor Pete.
And then makes his feelings felt by telling her he hates her.
Yeah, I've also made a note of that. He hates her even though he's fucked her.
Not Pete.
I thought there was a Mrs. Robinson thing going on.
No, it was referenced in the previous episode where his dad, Hank, called her Mrs. Robinson. That was him just being hurtful to them both rather than it being anything actual. I think it's definitely a weird dynamic. Possibly could be Oedipal, but they certainly haven't acted on any things, which is mad because Danvers definitely is not backwards about coming forwards about those things.
No, absolutely. I mean, her and Chris Frexton, I mean, they didn't actually do anything, but we know they have done in the past and quite clearly something could have happened there.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's sort of sticking around. Like, he's going to stay around now to deal with this, or to kind of help with this case, really. And it's nothing to do with him looking good for his mayoral campaign.
Mm.
It's got nothing to do with that, I think. I think, like we said previously, he's there to make sure that business interests in Ennis aren't upset by what's going on, right? It's the power structure, which is why we have that scene of when Peter says he's here. He's trying to take the body where Liz tries to go and stop him, but it's too late because she has to help a native girl who's not doing so well, who by the end of the episode ends up dying, and the powers that be maintain control and order of what they're doing.
I think at this point of the narrative, it's really important also to recognise that Danvers tells Christopher Eccleston that those men died before they froze and this is a murder case.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. He's like, how do you know we haven't had the forensics here yet? And she's like, oh, well, I did my own pre-forensic evaluation. I quite like their relationship. The dynamic of their relationship is really nice. She's like, you know, are you going to kick me out of my office or are you going to find somewhere else to work? There's kind of sort of gentle flirting going on, but also an antagonism between them as well at play because he's moved her out to Ennis in the first place and is potentially quite envious of her abilities as a police officer.
Definitely. And we also learned that much like in Ennis, in Anchorage, no one liked her. No one wanted to work with her because she told people outright they were shit at their job.
Yeah. I mean, there's also kind of late in the later conversation when she goes for a drunken booty call at his hotel. He sort of points out it got worse after Jake and Holden. So, yeah, you know, this was a little bit of a hint where we didn't find out necessarily any new information. We knew that something had happened to Jake and Holden. We just didn't know what it was. And we still don't know. But yeah, that was, we were just kind of reminded of all of that stuff in that moment. Let's talk about the ice caves, because I think the ice caves are going to play quite a big part in the couple of episodes. So Navarro says there were no ice caves in the area that Annie's body was found. But when they go to see Adam, the teacher, at his house, he reveals that, in fact, there is an ice cave system bordering the Brooks Range, but it's a death trap. You definitely don't want to go there.
And who tracked those ice caves, Adam?
It was Otis Heiss who mapped those.
Yeah.
Yeah, they need to track down Otis Heiss because he mapped the ice caves. If only they could find him, right? Yeah, but he also, the other thing he says is that the fossils, the bones they can see on the wall behind Annie Kotok in her video are whale bones, probably prehistoric whale bones. And we do know, you know, obviously
whales. You think they'll find Otis?
I'm pretty sure they will do it by the end of this episode. But what was I going to say? Oh, Wales. Yeah, Wales travel quite far, don't they? How do you get to Wales in a mini?
I don't know. How do you get to Wales in a mini?
I wish I could remember the motorway that would be the punchline to this.
On the M4.
Yeah. So, yeah, they then, we will come to the ending of it all, where we'll talk about them discovering Otis Heiss. But there's a few other bits we should probably talk about first. So, Hank, do we want to talk about Hank's...
Okay, so Hank is expecting his fiancée and the plane arrives. I think her name's Alina and she doesn't get off the plane. She goes back.
Well, I don't think that's Alina on the plane. I think that's
the stewardess.
No, I think it's the stewardess. He thinks it's Alina getting off the plane. Yeah. I think it's the stewardess closing the door. I mean, if she even exists, she was never on the plane at all.
Well, it means he can spend Christmas Day with his son.
Well, what's interesting is, yeah, Pete asks, where is she? Because everyone knows Hank is not available to look for these people because he's going to collect Alina from the airport. When Pete asks him and he's like, oh, well, she's got a sick mother. Maybe something's come up. Her phone's not working. There's a reason why. But deep down, he knows that he's been had because he comes back and he just makes his way through that bottle of whiskey, yeah, or bourbon or whatever it is. And Pete says, you didn't send her any money, did you? And he's like, no. Obviously he did. But the other thing is that we saw briefly is that she asked him for pictures. And I said this before, my worry is those pictures are going to be compromising and that's going to be something else that is used as blackmail against him.
He's not a likable character, so it wouldn't surprise me if the story compromises him in some way.
Yeah, again, I don't know whether this was just whether there's going to be any more play out from this, but I like that theory that those pictures will be used for something in the future. Yeah, it was just quite funny, him there with his cuddly rabbit with an Alaska shirt on it.
There were a lot of cuddly toys in this episode. Cuddly polar bear, cuddly rabbit. Interesting.
But when he goes back and we see that he's got this bottle of pink Tatlinger in the fridge.
Petals on the bed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's been on a long flight. She's probably going to be starving. And all she's going to come back to is a fridge that's got a bottle of pink Tatlinger and a six-pack of beer. I mean, I wouldn't be too impressed by that. I don't care how many roses you've shed all over the bed. I'm going to need some proper fucking food.
Let's move on to Rose. We mentioned her briefly before. I just reread my notes on this. I know I've already made the comparison to Jamie Lee Curtis in The Bear and her Christmas preparations. But my note was, she's the polar opposite. But yeah, all we really learn is that she was a serious professor in her past. Yes. She was an educated person. She found it was all meaningless, so much noise, and that it's quieter here, mostly, except for all the effing dead. So
I heard fucking dead.
Yeah, yeah. It's just stuck with kids in the house.
I guess the question is, when she answers the door to Navarro, is that a roll-up or a big old bifter?
Oh, I think it's definitely a big old bifter. But, like, who is she expecting to come over for Christmas dinner? Was it Navarro or was it someone else?
Good question. I initially wasn't sure. I think she made that for herself and she was expecting maybe a visit from Rusty's dad. And so all that food is kind of is symbolic for their time together. So in her head, whilst he's there, he's obviously not corporal made flesh. He's not going to be eating the food, but it's there. And that's how they can have that experience. I think she's hoping that he turns up spiritually.
And do we think she's just there for a bit of flavour, Fiona Shaw, in, you know, that sort of spooky dead people talk to me way?
Sorry, I think I can quote a famous philosopher when I say, what's your flavour? Tell me what's your flavour. I mean, she's got to be important in the second half of the series. You don't get Fiona Shaw in a show like that just for those little scenes.
Yeah, I don't think she offered much this episode, but yeah, definitely she's got a lot to deliver.
Well, someone else who hasn't yet delivered in her storyline is Leah, who again had a small part to play in this episode in that she has scrawled murderers on the doors to the offices of the mine. And so we get Kate McKittrick. Again, we're reminded of her as a character. And she wants to press charges on Christmas Eve. And Liz basically tells her no. And then she says please after that. So, you know, it's kind of like almost a kind of truce between the two of them. She basically, Liz calls her out and says, you only want to press charges to get back at me. And I'm not going to let you F up. Leah's life.
Classic Nepo baby stuff. Also, she says, look, don't worry about it. We'll get some guys to come and clean it up. So I guess she's saying that they will be municipal cleaners. It's not going to come out of the mine's pocket.
Yeah. And then Leah basically packs a bag and off she goes, right? Kayla picks her up. There's a really lovely sort of, you know, the antagonism between Kayla and Liz as well. And then, you know, later on we get Leah and Kayla and the grandma. You know, we talked about the crone and the mother and the maiden all baking together, this kind of native triumvirate of women.
And the traditions being passed down, because obviously the crone and the mother, as it were preparing the flour and kneading the dough. And then she turns up not knowing what to do, and they are teaching her how to do it. And with Leah's interest in her own kind of ethnic and cultural history, that very clearly is mirroring that.
And contrasting that, you know, her turkey is still uncooked. We called it a chicken last week. It is in fact a turkey, and it goes in the bin. And instead, she, you know, again, contrasting with Rose's lavish Christmas dinner, she's having a vodka dinner. We then get Navarro opening a Christmas present. I couldn't work out what this was. Was anyone able to tell what this was? There was a little tree outside her house with a present underneath that we saw her wrap. It was like a canister of something.
Sorry, we were talking over each other. I said I think it was some kind of watermelon or fruit flavour, and Neil said was it air freshener, and I think it's both.
And do we know what that's who left that and what that relates to?
It's got to be a fella, Mr. Moonshine.
Yeah, Kavik.
Yeah, that's the one.
She does go and see him, but this is after she goes and investigates Oliver Tagak again, right? Liz has seen something to do with lights. She watched the video of Annie again. She watches the video of Clark just before he flips out. And before each one, someone cuts the power. And they discuss why they put power in an ice cave. And that leads them down the line of a generator and Oliver Tagak, who was an equipment specialist. So she sends, because she's too drunk, Pryor to go and pick Navarro up, and they go and investigate Tagak. They get to his place. He's got a symbol on the wall. His place is frozen over, right? Again, this is weird to happen in this moment. They go in there and everything's iced over. And Pete says, this feels a lot like, and doesn't finish his sentence. And then they discover the swirl symbol on the cardboard and on a little rock thing.
Yeah, so the fact that everything's frozen is then confirmed by the other people that live there, that he hasn't been there for days. My worry was, obviously, the gun was across the arms of the chair, but so were a pair of boots, big, thick boots. And they were like, geez, has he just gone out into the tundra without proper footwear? I mean, he's going to catch a death of cold, isn't he? Let's be honest.
Nobody wants that. We also find out that he left the day after Danvers visited him.
Yeah, so then it's after this whole scene that Ange gets the news about Jules, right?
Yeah, just the other bit about Jules. So we see that Jules has left the facility. Well, she calls Ange before they even head off. Ange is asking her how the lighthouse is. She says it's fine in a not particularly convincing manner. And from what little we can see from the frame, she's outside. We can't see much, but there is a clue that she is in an exterior shot. And she says, after everything, yeah, I think it's going to work out. I love you. In a way that is foreboding as fuck.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you get from that that she's about to do something to end her life, to be honest, you know, for her to say that. And then we obviously see her heading out onto the ice naked.
Yeah, the camera pans out, doesn't it? Reveals that she's at the boat. And yeah, she folds her clothes in the same way the scientists did. And then off she goes out into the ice.
There is a callback to the previous episode where the two of them are there. She takes herself off there and Evangeline goes looking for her and finds her at the shipwreck. And they're talking about how Jules says she finds herself drawn back there over and over. And she says, over there is where the water is. We can't see it, but I know the water is over there. And Evangeline says, kind of like, okay, right. That's good to know, I guess. And then, yeah, we see this episode, that's what she does. She strips down and she walks off to eventually fall into the water where she drowns.
And Navarro's reaction to this is a little bit odd in places, in that she gets the bad news. She gets rid of Pete, essentially. She's like, no, you go and be with your family. I'm not going to burden you with this on Christmas Eve. Then she goes to the lighthouse and the people at the lighthouse don't even know that Jules has left. She kind of kicks off and trashes the reception, and then she goes from there and sees the guy from episode one, the sort of abusive guy, picks a fight with him and his mates and gets beaten up. So this sends Navarro into Kavik's arms, and she asks him, why are you alone? Had this whole conversation about being alone. He denies being alone. And she's like, you know, we're all alone. Liz is alone. I'm alone. You're alone. And he's like, no, you're not alone. And he does this fake out where he goes to propose to her, but then resets her wrist or shoulder or something.
Yeah, I think it's a finger. It might be a wrist, but it's definitely on her hand because he grabs her hand as if he was going to say, will you marry me? I absolutely loved that because she was so busy saying no to him that she had no clue at what he was doing. And it made me wonder, is Kavik medically trained? And if so, to what level? That you would just go, oh, I know how to reset this broken finger or wrist.
I think he's trained to be the coolest dude in Ennis, right?
Yeah, definitely.
But we get that sort of idea of being alone comes back up later on. Ange goes to see Navarro the next day. To be honest, they've both seen better days because Liz is very hungover. And she finds the polar bear. The polar bear toy falls out of a box, right?
Yeah.
And this reminds Ange of the dream that she had about Holden. And Liz says, dead people are dead. She throws the bear out of the door. And she says, we're here alone. The dead are gone. And that's when Navarro tells her, my sister killed herself last night. She just walked out. She says, it takes us one by one and you know who's next. Something calls us and we follow.
Whether it's bipolar, whether it's schizophrenia, it's coming for us. You saw some kind of spirit and then I saw nothing. You're a liar.
Yeah, so that's it. So she details what Jules was suspected of having. And then Evangelina says that it's a curse that afflicts their whole family and that she's seen stuff. And Liz is saying, no, that's bullshit. And that's where we kind of get more and more of that argument. That's when Liz says, yeah, you saw something there when we're talking about, obviously, this guy that we see is alive, but the official story is that he died. And so that's where Evangelina first sees a dead person talking, which she then sees at the end of the episode as well, right?
So do you think that Wheeler is actually still alive? I think he's dead, but I just don't think he killed himself. When Liz is throwing the polar bear out, it's because Navarro's suggesting she's kept hold of that polar bear toy because of Holden. And that's where she's saying dead people are dead. And the argument they have is when Liz says, you saw something in that room with Wheeler, a ghost or a spirit. And Ange says, I saw nothing. And again, at the same, similarly to the last episode, we see her seeing the screaming girl in Wheeler's room. At the same time as we're hearing Navarro saying, I saw nothing. Exactly the same as last week. We're seeing something different to what we're hearing. And again, I checked. This wasn't the same girl as was under Julia's bed, I don't think, because she wasn't wearing a cross.
We see also that Wheeler is still alive, right, in this flashback. So my money is on Evangelina sees this person, this spirit. She loses it because of her own personal history with regards to domestic violence. She kills Wheeler. Liz covers it up. And Liz says, basically, you have my silence. You can't work in the police anymore. You've got to be a state trooper. I think that's kind of how that goes down.
I mean, that all makes a lot of sense, right?
I think with Pete's journey, he follows Danvers' orders to work on Christmas Eve. And then when he gets to bed, he gets in bed with his partner and says, just say it. I ruined your life and you didn't want a baby. And I think that's going to be very interesting as events unfold.
Yeah, because we still don't think Pete's going to come to a sticky end, right?
Mm.
Okay, let's cover the ending then. So the fishermen have spotted something. There's a photo of a man walking in the coat, in Annie's coat. So they all think it's Clark. They talk about the dredges. I haven't had time to look into what the dredges were.
Assuming the dredger is the ship.
I don't know. It feels like it's some sort
That's
of...
That's where they went. They went to the ship. I mean, a dredger is a name for a ship. I'm assuming it's that. I mean, a dredger is a ship that, well, literally dredges the ocean. It, like, puts out nets and dredges up fish.
I think there are mining dredges as well, which are different things. So I don't know, but maybe we'll each do some individual research on that and come back next week better informed.
Well, they end up on a ship.
Do they? I don't know that it is a ship. They end up in something, certainly. There's graffiti on there. It says, keep off the grass. the sort of spider graffiti as well. There's a fire and a stereo. Someone has been there, and then they see somebody running. They also see the symbol. And so Liz chases the person who's running, and Evangeline hears a voice, hears her name being called, right? And she sees Julia's body floating away. She follows some small wet footprints, and Danvers catches up with the person, and it's Otis, not Clark, but he's wearing the coat. And Otis says that Clark has gone. He went back down to hide. He's hiding in the night country. We're all in the night country now.
Aren't we just?
Yeah, well, the other important thing is, as well, is that we also get a shot to a spoon and a lump. So Heist has been smoking crack in whatever industrial space this is, whether it's a building or a ship. So whatever he's doing,
it's a dredger. They're really bad for the environment. It is a ship, I promise you.
Okay, that's why I left it open. That my theory was inclusive of everyone. But I think, yeah, it's that idea that he is not there fully. So that, I guess, with him being under the influence of crack, that allows him to also be scared for his life and maybe see things that aren't really there in his altered state.
Well, speaking of altered states, Navarro, he sees the Christmas tree lights up and this distorted music. And then she turns to see a screaming woman, which I think was Jules. I think she had the chin markings and the blue hair. And then the next time we see Navarro, she's sitting down, kind of zoned out. And it looks to me like her ears are bleeding. Maybe her eardrums have burst, which is obviously one of the injuries that happened to the scientists and to Otis. So it suggests that the same thing that they've suffered has also been passed on to Navarro.
There's also footprints on the floor, which I guess we're guessing are Clark's, because Otis is still there.
The wet footprints, I think, the ones that Navarro sees, they're the Jules' phantom footprints.
Yeah, because we don't see Liz see those steps, do we? So that tends to suggest that they're not genuine.
I don't know. I mean, Navarro can see genuine stuff.
Yeah, but if we're saying that this is something that she's not really seeing, it's supernatural, some altered state that she's in, that her mind is playing tricks on her because of the long night. You know, if we saw Liz see those steps as well, then we can confirm that they are real, because two separate characters have seen something that can't be explained. It is at least real in that world. But we only see one character see it, and therefore that it's there for us to assume that it's not real, or it's part of whatever we're saying the science or pseudoscience is.
Are you suggesting Navarro can't be trusted?
Well, we already know that she's seen the body floating in there, so that she's already moving between these two realms, shall we say, for want of a better phrase. So is that, and there was really kind of classic horror tropes in that whole thing. It's the ultimate jump scare, isn't it? She turns around and she's right behind her. So I think we can assume safely that those footprints aren't real.
Well, a classic horror trope is an unreliable narrator.
Definitely.
So a couple of bits I wanted to just mention before. Oh, I mean, any other thoughts about that fight, about that ending? Or is it just kind of, well, let's wait and see what happens?
Okay, yeah, just the line, he's gone, he went back down to hide. So where has Otis gone? Something that is making me really excited about watching the next episode.
Well, it's not Otis, because Otis is the one that says it. You're right. The guy.
Sorry, not Otis, Clark.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder also if, in amongst all this dredgers that they're in, is there something in the air that can also lead to Navarro seeing what she's seeing? Is there some kind of gas or toxic pollutant still in the air as another explanation as to why she sees this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are going to end up with some sort of chemical explanation for all of these different things.
I think it'll be spiritual. I don't think it'll be chemical, the way it's going.
A couple of other bits I just wanted to quickly mention. One is that we get Connolly watching Elf on the telly, repeated later on with Hank watching Elf on the telly. So if you do find yourself watching Elf on Christmas Eve on your own, then, you know, we will judge you. And then the other thing I just wanted to comment on Jodie Foster's acting again. I mean, I think it's incredible stuff. I think it's up there with her performance in Silence of the Lambs. Wouldn't you agree, Demo?
So, well, let's get into it. I thought the WhatsApp group was a safe space. I did actually receive support from Izzy for this. But consternation from Grace and Adam. Neil's silence was, I thought, not only enigmatic, but also respectful. Yeah, exactly. I haven't seen Silence of the Lambs, or at least I haven't seen it all the way through. I've seen clips of it. I know all about and Chianti and all that jazz. But yeah, I haven't seen Silence of the Lamb, but I have seen Madame Foster in many other fantastic things.
Fair enough. Let's quickly cover the questions then. I don't think any questions were answered in this episode.
It was a filler episode, and shout out to Damo because he suggested that on the WhatsApp, not necessarily in those words, but it was a filler episode, but filler episodes aren't necessarily bad episodes.
I think we have had a question asked, or at least partly answered, and that is about Alina. We got more information about Hank and his online bride.
It wasn't one of our seven questions. It was one from a couple of weeks ago we had. I don't know whether we can qualify that as a reinstated question at this late stage. I mean, if we do, it will only give me another point, to be honest.
Then you go on that, Damo.
Can I table an amendment then? Yeah. No, John's over. Well, we are going to get more because he's blatantly going to get blackmailed over those pictures. But are we amending questions, Adam?
The questions we've got so far are, who is Lund talking about? I think we can probably park that one now because I don't know that we'll specifically find out the answer to that. What did Holden whisper to Ange? I still want to know that. What did Annie find in the caves? Who killed Wheeler? Where is Clark? How did the scientists end up on ice? And who killed Annie? Those are the sort of six outstanding questions that we have, I think. I mean, we could throw in, where is Oliver TikTok?
I got one because we didn't talk about it properly. So just to quickly cover it, is that when Liz is driving back drunk, she manages to avoid driving into a truck and then immediately sees a one-eyed polar bear in the road and crashes into a snowbank. So I think maybe we should have a question of, are we going to find out more about what the one-eyed polar bear is about?
What about how did the polar bear lose its eye?
That sounds like a kid's book, but yeah.
only in that the way you phrase the question is that if we don't find out any more about that, then that's the answer to that question is no, we're not going to find any more about it. Does that make sense?
That's why I'm asking it like that, so we can get some points.
Okay, we'll include where is Oliver TikTok, yes? What did Holden whisper to Ange? What did Annie find? Who killed Wheeler? Where's Clark? How did the scientists end up on ice? Who killed Annie? And how did the polar bear lose its eye?
Perfect.
So that's eight questions. How many do you think we'll get answered in episode 5?
2.
1.
I'm going to go with 3 this time round. Only 2 episodes left. We've gone long again, so we won't cover anything else in this episode, but we'll hopefully be back with another watch list episode so we can find out what amazing stuff Damo's been watching because we haven't heard from him recently. Anything, any one thing, Damo, you want to quickly shout out that you've been watching and enjoying?
As I was saying before we record, I'm currently watching a Channel 4 documentary, I think went out on 7th of January, called I Am Andrew Tate. I'm not enjoying it, but it's about an hour long and it's about basically Andrew Tate's rise. And infamy, he is incredibly horrible, man. And the documentary, I think, does show that there were some people complaining that it was giving him a platform and showing him in a positive light. I think he's quite clearly is being shown to be the narcissistic fake that he is. Listen to a watch list episode to hear more about all the other fantastic shows I've been watching.
Yeah, I just want to give a quick shout out to Big Boys, as I mentioned it when I last spoke with Neil, but I've finished that show now and I would give it 10 out of 10. I think it's incredible. Second season finale was superb. The 5th episode, one before that, was also very, very good. All about an online lads mag. And yeah, just very funny and well observed. And I also watched the first episode of Expats and I enjoyed that as well. That's made a promising start. So I'm going to watch more of that. And we'll report back. How about you, Neil?
I'm still on Survivor Australia. I know how much you love the Big Boys, Adam. I haven't had a chance to watch that yet, but I will. Damo, you're not watching Love Idol.
I think it's safe to say that that's absolutely not something I would watch.
Right, well, if you want to tell us what you would watch or your thoughts or theories on True Detective, you can contact us on the social media at TVDNAPod. Or you can email tvdnapod@gmail.com. Please do give us a rating and a review wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we haven't decided which episode we're going to watch for David Tennant University. And we've taken the risk with giving that up to you. So please do let us know which episode you want us to cover.
Yes, there is a poll on Spotify on that Hooniversity Challenge episode for Christopher Eccleston. I'll repeat that poll on the social media, and then we'll collate the polls together for one giant combined poll of our listeners' thoughts and theories and views on which David Tennant episode we should watch. Yeah, thanks very much, both.
Yeah, in the words of Otis Heiss, we're all in Night Country now.
And in the words of Otis Hemming, night, Dad.